Coon Review, Print Speaking to the Blind, celebrating 40 years of audio newspaper production. Welcome to this week's edition of the Herald Scotland podcast, recorded at the Bishop Briggs Media Centre by our amazing volunteers. You can get in touch with us via Facebook, Twitter or Instagram using @CoonReview, that is @CUEANDREVIEW. You can also contact us directly by emailing information@coonreview.com. That is information@CUEANDREVIEW.com. Or by calling 0141 772 3976. That's 0141 772 3976.
From the Herald Scotland, Thursday the 29th of February, from the sports section, Dundee team bus towed in Glasgow after Celtic hammering. Report by Ewan Payton. It was a bad night on and off the park for Dundee last night as they visited Glasgow. Tony Docherty's men were hammered 7-1 by Celtic at Parkhead, with their top six chances taking an almighty blow at the hands of the champions. The Hoops cast aside their Premiership opponents in easy fashion, with Brendan Rodgers' side 6-0 up at half-time. The goals came from Cameron Carter-Vickers, Adam Ida, Matt O'Reilly, Dyson Maeda, Greg Taylor, Callum McGregor and Daniel Kelly. The Hoops remained 2 points behind Rangers despite the result after they staged a second-half comeback to Kilmarnock to win 2-1. But the night didn't end there for Dundee, with their journey back up the A9 delayed after the team bus broke down. They didn't even make it out of the East End before the bus faltered, with photos emerging on social media of it being towed away on London Road. It's been claimed by users on X that the Celtic team bus had to drop off Celtic's players before returning to rescue them. Rodgers said it felt as though Celtic had rolled back the years to his first spell in charge of the club, with their mauling of Dundee, and he hopes it was the moment the synergy between himself, the team and the supporters were re-established. It felt more like when I was here the first time, that ruthless mentality of the team, simplicity of the game and the football we played, Rodgers said. And that's why we're here, to entertain the supporters. There was a really nice moment at half-time when they were coming in. The fans could see how the level of performance had jumped up. We had everything we wanted from the game. The runs, the movement, the ambition. And that report was by Ewan Payton. From the Herald Scotland, Thursday the 29th of February, from the sports section, the cold Philippe Clement quote Rangers fans are loving. Report by Ewan Payton. In the eyes of Rangers fans, Philippe Clement can do no wrong. The Belgian has turned the club's fortune around spectacularly in less than 6 months in charge of the Ibrox side. He's guided them to League Cup success, the last 16 of the Europa League, and to the top of the Premiership table despite being 7 points behind Celtic earlier this season. Last night's 2-1 victory over Kilmarnock at Rugby Park was described by the 49-year-old as a massive moment in the title fight as he maintained their 2-point lead at the summit. And Rangers fans on social media were loving Clement's cold comment when speaking to the media after the game in Ayrshire. He heaped praise on Derek McInnes and Kelly, who were more than decent in the match as they battled to get the result in their quest for fourth spot. Clement pointed out that they've been in an impressive run of form themselves since early December, however, have come up short only to his side. It's the players who do it, it's about them, the manager said. It's these nights that need to be a reference in their heads for the future. You can speak to about 11 players or 15 or 16 players who did major things to get a result. Also, all credit to Derek and his team, who made it a really big fight. Also, what they've been doing all these months. Now, in 15 games, Kilmarnock have only lost twice, 2 times against us. The rest they didn't lose one of the games. Huge credit to Kilmarnock that they made it a really big fight. Of course, they're more used to these circumstances, and we had to take them to adapt to these circumstances also. That was a big difference in the second half. And that report was by Ewan Payton.
This is from the Herald Scotland on Thursday the 29th of February 2024, from the news section. Emma Caldwell murderer Ian Packer sentenced to life in prison. This article is written by Sarah Ward. Serial rapist Ian Packer has been sentenced to life imprisonment with a minimum term of 36 years after being found guilty of murdering Emma Caldwell in 2005. Packer, 51, was found guilty on Wednesday of murdering Miss Caldwell, 27, who went missing in Glasgow on April 4, 2005, and whose body was found in Limefield Woods near Robertson, South Lanarkshire, the following month. He was also convicted of 11 charges of rape against 9 women and 21 other offences over a period of 26 years, following a 6-week trial at the High Court in Glasgow. Police Scotland has apologised to the family of Miss Caldwell and his other victims for being let down by policing in 2005. Packer was first interviewed by police the month after Miss Caldwell's body was found. Following his conviction, Police Scotland Assistant Chief Constable Beck Smith said in a statement, "Emma Caldwell, her family, and many other victims were let down by policing in 2005. For that, we are sorry. A significant number of women and girls who showed remarkable courage to speak up at that time also did not get the justice and support they needed and deserved from Strathclyde Police." Miss Caldwell vanished days after telling her mother Margaret about her hopes to kick a heroin addiction, which began following a family bereavement in her early 20s. She came from a close-knit family and saw both parents twice a week and spoke to them daily and was reported missing after she failed to respond to attempts by them to change a planned meeting. A dog walker found Miss Caldwell's body in woodland with a garrote around her neck on May the 8th, 2005. During Packer's trial, the court heard a soil sample taken in 2021 from the site where Miss Caldwell's body was found was a 97% match with soil found in his blue work van, and Packer was charged by police in February 2022. Packer denied all the charges, accusing all the women of lying, but admitted during evidence that he indecently assaulted Miss Caldwell. He said he was ashamed of his actions towards her and described his behaviour towards another sex worker as being disgusting. But he denied murdering Miss Caldwell in his evidence, telling the court, "It wasn't me who killed her. It wasn't me. I didn't do anything to her." The trial heard evidence from multiple women about Packer's brutal attacks on them. Prosecutor Richard Goddard, KC, described Packer as a violent and obsessive user of sex workers with an unhealthy addiction to procuring their services. 2 charges of sex assault and 1 of indecent assault were found not proven. The jury took 4 days to return their verdict. That article was written by Sarah Ward. This is from the Herald Scotland on Thursday the 29th of February 2024, from the news section. Ferry fiasco costs staggering £1.3 million a week under ScotGov control. This exclusive article is written by Martin Williams. Scotland's ferry building fiasco has cost the public more than £1.3 million a week since the Scottish Government took control of the shipyard at the centre of the scandal just over 4 years ago, the Herald can reveal. The latest capital costs of the 2 wildly delayed and over-budget ferries being built at nationalised Ferguson Marine, which do not include Scottish Government budget payments for running costs and salaries, are currently estimated to be at £425.5 million. That's nearly 4.5 times the original £97 million contract cost. It can be revealed that the extra cost to complete the ferries since nationalisation has rocketed by £297.3 million. It has risen by a further £185 million since the Scottish Government appointed turnaround director Tim Hare estimated it would cost £112.3 million to finally complete Glen Sannox and Glen Rosa immediately after Ferguson Marine was nationalised in December 2019. Just over 2 years later, Ferguson Marine Chief Executive David Tidman, in his first analysis after taking over from Mr. Hare on February 1, 2022, put the further post-nationalisation costs up by £8.2 million from the Tim Hare calculation at around £120.5 million. The soaring post-nationalisation costs have come after £128.25 million was ploughed into the project when the yard was under the leadership of tycoon Jim McColl. Since September last year, when it was estimated the extra post-nationalisation costs would be £269 million, it has gone up again by around £28 million. In his latest estimate, Mr. Tidman has set a ceiling of £150 million for the delivery of Glen Rosa and believes Glen Sannox will be complete at around £147.3 million. He has stated he hopes to bring the cost of Glen Rosa down to below £140 million. The two ferries being built at Inverclyde Shipyard were due online in the first half of 2018, with one initially to serve Arran and the other to serve the Skye Triangle routes to North Uist and Harris, but are at least 6 years late. It has been confirmed that both are now to serve Arran. Glen Sannox was launched by Nicola Sturgeon nearly 7 years ago and is not expected to be ready for passengers till August at the earliest. Glen Rosa was meant to be delivered to Calmac in August 2018, but that is currently scheduled to be completed in May 2025, meaning it would be ready for passengers the following August. The dates of arrival and the costs have been in a constant state of flux, as their construction has been plagued by design challenges, cost overruns, and delays. In the midst of the delays and soaring costs, Ferguson Marine, under the control of tycoon Jim McColl, fell into administration and was nationalised at the end of 2019, with state-owned ferry owners and procurers Caledonian Maritime Assets Limited, CMAL, and the yard's management blaming each other. A ferry user group official said that the extent of the issues with the ferries had been clearly underestimated from the first day of the Scottish Government takeover. The blame game on who was responsible is one thing, but the Scottish Government was supposed to turn this around, hence the turnaround director. But we have never come close to getting the costs or the dates of arrival for these ferries right, and it has been under Scottish Government control for over 4 years. The wanton mismanagement of this project remains something I can scarcely believe, and the costs are staggering. The new Wellbeing Economy Secretary has said that the latest cost increases and delays to delivery dates were extremely disappointing. Her predecessor, Neil Gray, had made similar comments on previous cost rises and repeated that further delays and cost increases would be inexcusable and profoundly frustrating. She is planning an urgent conversation with the chairman of Ferguson Marine, Andrew Miller, to agree next steps and set out my very clear expectations about future governance. Scottish Conservative Shadow Transport Minister Graham Simpson said the ferries have to be the worst value for money of anything in public procurement history. He added, a succession of SNP ministers has expressed disappointment with the cost increases, but they never act to stop it. There has been a blank cheque for these ferries since day one. The latest minister to be in charge of this scandal says the delays and cost increases are inexcusable. Fortunately for her, we appear to be near the end of the building of these two vessels, so she might be the lucky one to see them go into service. Mr. Tidman said in his latest update that there has been significant rework on Glen Sannox on what he called legacy issues and design and construction errors in the early stages. With pre-nationalisation Ferguson Marine, and then since the Scottish Government took over. Among the issues with both vessels involved safety clearance failures last June, which led to a redesign and installation of new evacuation routes in order to satisfy the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency, MCA, which is responsible for implementing British and international maritime law and safety policy. Mr. Tidman admitted he knew about the problems within 3 months of him joining the firm in February 2022, but the issues did not become public knowledge until September 2023. The changes mean the two vessels will carry nearly 300 passengers fewer than contracted for, to allow for improved passenger seating layouts. The two lifeline ferries, Glen Sannox and Glen Rosa, were both due to hold up to 1,000 passengers when they eventually come into service. There have also been issues with the engine systems, as Ferguson Marine struggled to find a company to install the so-called green LNG technology needed for it to be environmentally friendly. It will run on diesel until this is sorted. Our aim is to avoid all such rework on the second ship, he said. We have had more opportunity to build Glen Rosa differently, and the strategy of deferring the outfitting work until we have finished the build of Glen Sannox creates the scope to avoid the extensive rework encountered on Glen Sannox. Consistently over the past 18 months, we have set out that Glen Sannox has been a complex design and engineering challenge, made harder by many legacy issues with the past, administration and pandemic impacts. We have also set out that Glen Rosa will be a delivery challenge, well planned, with contractors engaged and the opportunity to complete the build far more efficiently. That article was written by Martin Williams. This is from the Herald Scotland on Thursday the 29th of February 2024, from the news section. Radisson to launch UK hotel and service department concept in Glasgow. This article is written by Craig Williams. Multinational hospitality brand Radisson has announced Glasgow as the location for its first hotel and service departments in the UK. Located in the city centre and with a target opening date of 2027, it will be the first service department offering for the group in the UK. The brand new upscale development will consist of a combination of stylish, contemporary, standard and superior bedrooms, along with spacious luxury studio and one-bed apartments in the signature Radisson design, the hotel group notes. Plans also include for a high-end rooftop bar and lounge, providing panoramic views across the city and a stunning destination restaurant on the ground floor, as well as a gym and meeting space. The proposed site for the new property is at 90 to 96 Maxwell Street and 40 Fox Street, which is currently occupied by a dilapidated former warehouse building. Adela Christia, Vice President Business Development UK, Ireland and Nordics at Radisson Hotel Group, said, "This is an exciting time for Radisson Hotel Group. This is the first service department concept signing in the UK for us, and we are absolutely thrilled to showcase it in Glasgow." Radisson Hotel and Service Departments Glasgow will perfectly complement our award-winning Radisson Red and Radisson Blue properties, both of which are established, great brand representations in this amazing city. This new development will provide more choice for guests, with a home-from-home experience within the luxury of a Radisson environment. Jay Singh, Director of Regent Property Glasgow, said, "We are delighted to work on this new venture with such a prestige brand by our side, and we look forward to making a significant contribution to the regeneration of the Clydeside and St Enoch area." That article was written by Craig Williams.
These letters are from a selection in the Herald on Thursday, the 29th of February 2024. They are from the Voices section, and the headline for the first letter is "Please Stop the Showboating." I write in total exasperation on reading and hearing on nearly every news outlet on a daily basis that our SNP leaders, ministers, MSPs and acolytes seem to be obsessed with matters happening everywhere else on the planet, except, it appears, in their own backyard. Wouldn't it be refreshing and novel to hear some impassioned debate in the chambers of both Holyrood and Westminster about real announcements of measures that are actually being put in place now to sort out our broken road and ferry transport infrastructure, our beleaguered NHS, our scrambled education system, our stretched to breaking point care provision, broken promises, shelved plans? The fact is, our so-called politicians are way too busy showboating in the media or in public. They are keen to be seen championing causes and highlighting injustices that bear little or no relevance to the reality on the ground here, in their own backyard, Scotland. As citizens of this beleaguered country, we should be reminding these highly paid representatives of the people why they have been elected to their respective parliaments. They have been entrusted to govern this country, fight for the rights of our citizens and grow our economy and society in a practical and sustainable way. Enough of the faux outrage, the huffing and bluster and finger-pointing. Can we please have some adult, educated, literate government? And if you could manage to show us a new boat anytime soon, that would be a bonus. Colin Allison, Blairgowrie. So, the SNP is spending more of the money which should be spent on Scottish needs in foreign aid, this time to Malawi. £500,000 to help charities tackle food insecurity, the Herald, February 24. They will receive a further £500,000, while we who pay taxes to this SNP government are getting less and less. While Malawi might need money, foreign aid is the role of the UK government. So the next time the SNP says it doesn't have enough money from the UK to fund schools, roads, education, health and the like, ask how much it gave away on foreign aid. Elizabeth Hands, Armadale. It's time they admitted defeat. Nothing in Scotland is working. From late ferries to violence in the classrooms and almost everything in between. The much-promised free school meals are now under financial threat too. The Scottish Government is not focused on any of its core responsibilities. As time passes, this appears to be because it is simply not capable. If the SNP Green Coalition really has Scotland's best interests at heart, it is now time to throw in the towel and let another party try. There is no shame in admitting defeat, but there is a great deal of shame in prolonging the agony for an entire country. Dr. Gerald Edwards, Glasgow. This article is from the Herald on Thursday, the 29th of February, 2024. It is from the Voices section and the headline is "Lee Anderson Row. Scots politicians can guard against racism," and it's written by Rebecca McQuillan. Suella Braverman, a former Tory Home Secretary, wrote an inflammatory article asserting without evidence that Islamists, extremists and anti-Semites are in charge now. In the US, Liz Truss, a former prime minister, was interviewed by former Trump strategist Steve Bannon and stayed scandalously silent when he hailed British far-right figure Tommy Robinson as a hero. Lee Anderson MP, former Tory deputy chairman, gave vent to Islamophobia, claiming in a GB News interview that Islamists controlled the Muslim mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, and London itself. Then Paul Scully, a Tory MP, claimed parts of Tower Hamlets in London and Sparkhill in Birmingham had become no-go areas, which he retracted after a fierce rejection of his remarks from the communities in question. What has Rishi Sunak done about all this? Much less than you'd expect. Downing Street said only that Sunak did not agree with Mr. Scully. There was silence on Braverman's comments. Ministers insisted Truss did nothing wrong. Lee Anderson had the whip removed, but ministers fell over themselves to avoid calling his remarks racist or Islamophobic. When asked why Anderson was wrong, Immigration Minister Michael Tomlinson failed to give an answer on LBC six times. Nick Ferrari ended the interview in disgust. Sadiq Khan knew why. He said Anderson was pouring fuel on the fire of anti-Muslim hatred. Anderson has refused to apologise. There will be many people worrying that we are starting to see the creeping normalisation of racism in British politics. Here in Scotland, in the devolution era, we have had more than our share of divisive politics, but racist and anti-immigration rhetoric has not, mercifully, been the stubborn perennial problem it seems to be at Westminster. Prejudiced outbursts still land here, though. The amplification of language associated with the far right can be seen all over Europe. Scotland has no protective shield against its pernicious influence. So, what can Scottish politicians do to stop the bile here? They can stand publicly together against it, pledging in writing never to tolerate it in their ranks, and they can make sure they follow through. All the parties have to meet the challenge. In Labour, the poison has principally been anti-Semitism. Keir Starmer showed woeful misjudgment over Rochdale by-election candidate Azhar Ali, suggesting initially that an apology for amplifying hateful anti-Jewish conspiracy theories was sufficient to allow Labour to continue supporting him, before later dumping him as candidate. It dented Starmer's moral credibility, even though he's taken a robust approach against other party figures over anti-Semitism. To keep the hatred out of politics, political leaders have to be decisive, firm and consistent, because out there, away from the broadcast studios, real people are paying the price. Dr. Mohamed Andries is chair of the Muslim Council of Scotland. He says that when politicians make divisive remarks about Muslims or Muslim communities, a wave of fear goes across the country. They create stress among Muslims, particularly school children and university students who are most affected by social media. For elders in the Muslim community, he says, it sparks deep anxiety about whether certain politicians have an agenda to kick Muslims out. I expect politicians to lead their communities. With comments like this, they are instigating hatred, he says. Islamophobic incidents since October have reached three times the level they did in the same 4 months the year before. That comes alongside a huge spike in anti-Semitic attacks, which hit a record high in the UK in 2023. Many Jews report feeling fearful. In Scotland, reported attacks doubled compared to 2022. The Hamas atrocities of October 7 and subsequent war in Gaza may be principally responsible, but politicians' words do their own damage. Hard right politicians like Anderson like to claim they are speaking for real people, implying their views are the majority view, but that's demonstrably untrue. Nasser Mir is Professor of Social and Political Sciences at Glasgow University. He points to the evidence. They are speaking to a base, but it is smaller than they claim. For example, in UK-wide polling in 2018 by Servation, the majority of the UK-wide samples asked saw no issue and were comfortable with Muslims as their neighbours, 79%, colleagues, 86%, and their children's friends, 82%, as well as if Muslims were in senior positions of responsibility in society. While there is a generational feature to this, with older people being less comfortable and younger people being more so, it's obviously not the case that Islamophobic politicians speak for the majority in any sense of the word. Yet the politicians who would fan division are tireless. This is alarming for Black and minority ethnic communities in Scotland. Colin Clark, Professor of Sociology and Social Policy at the University of the West of Scotland and board member of the Coalition for Racial Equality and Rights, says we are quite complacent about racism in Scotland. Ours is a nation often characterised as welcoming, but surveys of racism tell a different story. On the ground, that might mean graffiti on religious buildings, bricks through windows, or being subjected to hateful abuse on the bus. We can at least be glad that Scottish politicians have generally avoided fanning the flames. There has overall been a positive consensus in Holyrood about diversity. And of course, the country's two most high-profile politicians, currently being Muslims, Humza Yousaf and Anas Sarwar, is a positive distinction for Scotland. We can take nothing for granted, though. Here is what Scottish politicians could do to help keep divisive racist bile out of Scottish politics. All five Holyrood party leaders could sign a pledge never to tolerate racist language in public discourse against any group, on their own benches or any other. They might also sign up to reject prejudice against any minority community. Professor Clark and Dr. Andries would both support such a move. It would take political courage, but with harmful language starting to pose a threat to personal and community safety, and ultimately democratic politics itself, our leaders should find it. That report was by Rebecca McQuillan.
This is from the Herald Scotland on Friday, the 1st of March, 2024. From the news section. Ministers break key pledge as fuel poverty levels hit 12-year high. Exclusive by Martin Williams, senior news reporter. Ministers have come under fire for failing to fulfil pledges to eradicate fuel poverty after it hit a 12-year high, with over one in three now affected despite government moves to support the most vulnerable in the cost of living crisis. Scottish Government modelling under the Ofgem energy price cap, seen by the Herald, estimates that from January to March 2024, there will be around 840,000 households in Scotland suffering from fuel poverty. That's around 34% of households. It comes as ministers set the seal on the cancellation of the £30 million Fuel Insecurity Fund, which was last year described by First Minister Humza Yousaf, MSP, as a vital lifeline for thousands of struggling households. The Scottish Government set a target that in the year 2040, no more than 5% of households would be in fuel poverty. It came after a previous pledge was made to ensure that by November 2016, so far as is reasonably practicable, people are not living in fuel poverty in Scotland. Fuel poverty relates to households that must spend a high proportion of their household income to keep their home at a reasonable temperature. It is affected by three key factors: a household's income, their fuel costs, and their energy consumption, which in turn is affected by the energy efficiency of the home. In Scotland, it means that after housing costs, the total fuel costs needed to maintain a satisfactory heating regime are more than 10% of the household's total taxable income.
official analysis shows that in the past 12 years, only 2013 comes close to the current estimated levels, with 31.7% at that point recorded as being in fuel poverty. Simon Francis, coordinator of the End Fuel Poverty Coalition, commented, "The targets to end fuel poverty in Scotland and in the rest of the UK have never looked so distant. One of the key solutions is for faster upgrades of homes to improve energy efficiency and to move to heat pumps. But even while the Scottish Government can promise to upgrade more homes, unless we see structural reform in the energy markets, we are unlikely to see fuel poverty eradicated. What needs to happen is the decoupling of the price of electricity from the price of gas and reform of how energy firms buy and sell power. This will mean that the benefits of the cheaper renewables generated in Scotland can be passed on to the customers directly." The Fuel Insecurity Fund was a vital part of Scottish households' defence against surging energy bills. Last week, Ofgem said that the new price cap will be set at £1,690 from April, the lowest for 2 years. It means a drop of £238 a year, or around £20 a month, for a household using a typical amount of energy since the winter. But the cap remains 62% higher than 3 years ago, when energy prices began to surge as the global economy recovered from COVID-19 lockdowns. The invasion of Ukraine in late February 2022 then prompted a further jump in prices, as Western allies sought to economically isolate Russia, a major gas and oil supplier. This winter, there was no reintroduction of a £400 energy bill support scheme to help households, as was the case last winter, when the UK government's energy price guarantee set average dual fuel bills at £2,500 per year. "It is far too premature for politicians to think that the crisis is over," added Mr. Francis. "We would urge politicians from across political parties to call for reform to standing charges, better regulation of the energy industry, and a proper windfall tax on those firms profiting from the misery households face." The Scottish Fuel Poverty Advisory Panel has been raising concerns about the particularly worrying rising levels of fuel poverty in Scotland. The panel, which oversees the Scottish Government's progress in its strategy for tackling fuel poverty and acts as a statutory consultee, told ministers that it was hard to see where the Scottish Government budget, with the cut to the Fuel Insecurity Fund, FIF, leaves the statutory fuel poverty targets. Since it was set up in 2020, the fund has provided £9 million in heating grants to those struggling with bills, paid for 81,000 top-up vouchers for prepayment meters, and supported 55,000 tenants through a social landlord scheme. In March last year, the First Minister announced a commitment to double the FIF from £10 million to £20 million and triple it to £30 million for 2023-24. When he assumed office in March this year, the First Minister made a strong commitment to reducing fuel poverty, saying, "In a country as energy rich as Scotland, we should not have people living in fuel poverty. It is, of course, only as a result of the UK government's mismanagement of the economy and the cost of living crisis that we are having to take this action. This Scottish government will always put the interests of the people of Scotland first." The panel have been urging ministers to provide even a slimmed down FIF in 2024-25 to avoid a cliff edge for the people who currently rely on support. It said the FIF has and does provide vital support for fuel poor people who are amongst the most vulnerable living in Scotland. The panel had been concerned over the extreme fuel poverty rate from March, which estimates there were 739,500 households in extreme fuel poverty, around 29% of homes. That's a rise from 12.4% in 2019. The panel said that there was a stark contrast in the current extreme fuel poverty rate and the targets that have been set. Its pre-winter analysis stated that it is concerned that Ofgem's price cap calculation does not adequately recognise costs, either of heating a home with electricity or the average costs for those who rely on unregulated fuels. It said it therefore fails to recognise the fuel cost consumption for those living off gas grid. A UK government study shows the areas that have the highest concentrations of homeowners that are off the gas grid are in Orkney, 100% or 11,000 homes, Shetland, 100% or 11,000 homes, Western Isles, 88% or 13,000 homes, Highland, 61% or 74,000 homes, and Argyll and Bute, 56% or 27,000 homes. Energy Minister Gillian Martin said, "These findings highlight the real challenges faced by homeowners from increased energy prices, the most important factor behind fuel poverty. I welcome the continued improvement in the energy efficiency of our building stock, although we need to do more to meet our climate targets and eliminate energy efficiency as a driver of fuel poverty. It is the UK government that has continually failed to take the necessary steps to support people now and make the necessary changes, which only it can take to ensure households and businesses never experience an energy crisis like this again. This includes providing meaningful, targeted support to those who need it most, including the introduction of a social tariff on energy bills, which would protect our most vulnerable from energy price shocks in future." That article was by Martin Williams. This is from the Herald Scotland on Friday, the 1st of March, 2024, from the news section. George Galloway wins chaotic Rochdale by-election. Article by Jody Harrison. George Galloway has won the Rochdale by-election after a controversial and chaotic campaign. Mr. Galloway's campaign team claimed early on in the night that the former Labour and Respect MP would win comfortably, and so it proved. The Workers' Party of Great Britain leader received just under 40% of the vote. In his victory speech, Mr. Galloway began by focusing on Palestine, saying, "Keir Starmer, this is for Gaza. You have paid, and you will pay, a high price for the role that you have played in enabling, encouraging, and covering for the catastrophe presently going on in occupied Palestine in the Gaza Strip." He said he would put Rochdale councillors on notice that he intended to form a grand alliance to clean the town hall up at the local elections in May. After he was interrupted by a heckler accusing him of being a climate change denier, and confetti was thrown at him, he went on to pledge to campaign for the return of a maternity ward to Rochdale and to help save the town's troubled football club. His majority of 5,697 votes amounted to 18.3% of the total, on a turnout of 39.7%, a little higher than the two recent by-elections in Wellingborough and Kingswood. The surprise runner-up was David Tully, a local businessman and independent candidate who secured more than 6,600 votes. The Rochdale campaign has been mired in controversy and claims of intimidation and divisive tactics. Labour withdrew support for its candidate, Azar Ali, after a recording emerged in which he claimed Israel was complicit in the terrorist attacks of October the 7th, seeing Mr. Galloway become the firm favourite for the seat. Mr. Ali remained listed as the Labour candidate as the party's decision came too late for ballot papers to be changed. Reform UK's leader, Richard Tice, claimed his candidate, former Rochdale MP Simon Danksuk, had received a death threat during the campaign and said his party's campaign team had been subject to daily intimidation and slurs. Recriminations continued after polls closed, with Mr. Tice alleging to the PA news agency that menacing behaviour had featured throughout the campaign and questioned the validity of the postal ballots returned during the contest. He said, "This by-election and result should act as a serious wake-up call to those in power and indeed to the entire electorate. We are supposed to be a beacon of democracy. This shameful contest has been more characteristic of a failed state." Former Reform UK leader Nigel Farage had previously criticised postal voting on a number of occasions following defeats for his various parties. The party's candidate, Mr Danksuk, represented the seat for Labour but was barred from standing for the party in 2017 after he admitted sending inappropriate messages to a 17-year-old girl. Mr Danksuk secured a little more than 6% of the vote, coming sixth behind Mr Ali, the former Labour candidate. Independent candidate William Howarth agreed with Mr Tice that there had been an element of intimidation during the campaign, but Mr Galloway denied his supporters had engaged in any intimidation and claimed in Sky News that Mr Tice had invited him to be a Reform UK candidate in a recent by-election. He added that he hoped he would be introduced to the Commons by Conservative former Minister Sir David Davis and the former Labour leader and now independent MP Jeremy Corbyn. A spokesperson for the charity Campaign Against Anti-Semitism said, "George Galloway has an atrocious record of baiting the Jewish community." They added, "Given his historic inflammatory rhetoric and the current situation faced by the Jewish community in this country, we are extremely concerned about how he may use the platform of the House of Commons in the remaining months of this Parliament." That article was by Jodie Harrison. This is from the Herald Scotland on Friday, the 1st of March, 2024. From the news section, Scottish Conservative Conference kicks off with attack on Greens. Article by Jodie Harrison. Humza Yousaf is being challenged to end the SNP's power-sharing agreement with the Scottish Greens at Holyrood, with the Tory deputy leader in Scotland insisting the two Green ministers need to be kicked out of government. A deal struck by former First Minister Nicola Sturgeon led to Scottish Green co-leaders Patrick Harvey and Lorna Slater becoming ministers. But Megan Gallagher will use her speech to her party's conference on Friday to demand that arrangements with the extreme Greens be brought to an end. She will tell the conference, taking place in Aberdeen, that the Bute House agreement between the two parties needs ripped up. Ms Gallagher will insist, "Patrick Harvey and Lorna Slater need to be kicked out of government. The Greens need to be sent back to the extreme fringes of our politics, where they belong." Her comments come after veteran MSP Fergus Ewing, who has been suspended by the SNP for voting against Ms Slater in a no-confidence vote, also called on the First Minister to put the agreement with the Greens to a fresh vote within the party. Former SNP leadership candidate Kate Forbes has also called for the deal to be ended. And Ms Gallagher will say, "It is past time that Humza Yousaf listened to the growing calls across Scotland and even within his own party." She will tell Conservatives, "We know that the Greens are anti-business, anti-growth and anti-common sense. Whether it is the deposit return scheme or the gender recognition reform bill, they have no clue what people's priorities are. They are bad news for Scotland, and it's time for the Bute House agreement to end. It's not working." As well as attacking the Scottish Greens, Ms Gallagher will also blast the SNP, saying their political obsession with independence means they have no vision when it comes to the health service, education or the economy. She will say, "This is a government that exists for one goal and one goal only, breaking up our country." Ms Gallagher will state, "Scotland's NHS is suffering, as are our schools, economy, roads and justice system. Yet the SNP have no vision, no plan for any of them. The only plans they have produced are plans for their political obsession. In less than 2 years, the SNP have set out 10 plans for an independent Scotland. They are not worth the paper they are written on." But Green North East Scotland MSP Maggie Chapman said the Tories must apologise for the human cost and the pain they have inflicted. Ms Chapman, her party's economy spokesperson at Holyrood, said the Tory conference will be an exercise in denial and a celebration of policies that have plunged so many people and families into poverty. They have given us a Brexit that they all know is a disaster, costing jobs, hiking prices, and curbing our rights to live and travel in 27 other countries. They have given us the car crash of Trussonomics, which we are all still paying for, and they have given us a cost of living crisis, with bills and inflation hugely outstripping wages. If they have any contrition or dignity, then they must open with a full and frank apology for the human cost and the pain they have inflicted. An SNP spokesperson said, Scotland has paid a heavy price for 14 years of Tory chaos. Liz Truss's disastrous mini-budget to a Brexit we didn't vote for and hardline austerity policies that target the most vulnerable, the people of Scotland are forced to deal with the consequences of Tory incompetence. No wonder a poll out today shows the Tories are set for their record lowest vote share at the next election, while the SNP continues to command trust with Scottish voters. Voters have the opportunity to make Scotland Tory-free at the upcoming election by voting SNP and securing a brighter future with independence. The Scottish Government has also been contacted for comment. That article was by Jodie Harrison.
The Herald on the 1st of March and the Voices section. Free university tuition in Scotland must not disappear, by Ian McConnell. The issue of free university tuition for people living in Scotland, which never seems that far from the headlines, was thrust into the spotlight again this week. It was raised by First Minister Hamza Yousaf in the wake of comments from Michael Mara at the recent Scottish Labour conference in Glasgow. Labour MSP Mr Mara declared, "We are not talking about tuition fees, but we were talking about having to find a new formula, a new way of addressing that system." Pressed on what that would look like during a fringe event organised by the University of Dundee, he said, "There's lots of models across Europe. So there's post hoc in terms of after the event, things that we had previously, whether it be graduate taxes, whether it be endowments." Mr Yousaf declared this week the pro-Brexit Labour Party has failed Scotland's young people. Worse still, senior Labour figures in Holyrood hinted last week at the introduction of backdoor tuition fees in Scotland. Let me be clear, the SNP will always fight to protect Scotland's values and ensure that education will always be free in Scotland. From the perspective of the Scottish economy, this categorical statement from the First Minister was heartening, and Mr Mara's comments were somewhat alarming. There's no doubt that the issue of free university tuition for people in Scotland for their first degree has been something of a political hot potato since devolution. However, all too often the broader economic implications of free university tuition or what its abolition would mean are lost in the political cut and thrust. Scotland, as well as the UK as a whole and many other countries, makes much of its ambitions to drive economic growth partly on the back of a highly skilled workforce. There was always much hand-wringing over productivity. To say that free university tuition is not sustainable is quite simply wrong. The Scottish Government does not have huge powers when it comes to the public finances, but it is clear from what we have seen already that free university tuition is most definitely a choice that can be made. Many who do not like Scotland's greater income tax burden for higher earners ask what people get in return for this compared with other parts of the UK. Free university tuition is one very valuable extra thing. Furthermore, if Mr. Mara wants to talk about Europe, he might want to reflect on the existence of free university tuition in many other European countries. He could start by looking at the Nordic region, then move south and consider the situation in the likes of the public universities of Germany and Greece. Much was made recently of a cutting of funded university places for people in Scotland by the Scottish Government. This was a newsworthy event, but what may have been lost on many people who read only the top lines is the context that this related to the removal of extra places that were put in place amid the coronavirus pandemic. It would, of course, be good to see a free university tuition throughout the UK. Sadly, however, Sir Keir Starmer has abandoned the pledge he made at the time of the Labour leadership contest in 2020 to deliver free university tuition for people in England. He is giving the impression there is no money to do this. However, free university tuition could obviously be accommodated by tweaking UK tax and spending decisions, and it would not, in reality, be that difficult. It seems, though, that Sir Keir would rather give us something resembling a rerun of Nick Clegg's staggering U-turn on university fees south of the border in 2010, when the then leader of the Liberal Democrats went into coalition with the Conservatives. People in Scotland who would like to see the nation's economy become ever more skills-based, with greater value-added activity, increased productivity, and a consequent boost to living standards, should surely support free university tuition. Then again, you get the impression that some doomsayers would quite simply rather carp and would rather things to be worse than better. It surely makes no sense at all to limit the talent pool by making higher education readily available only to those who can afford it. Look at the huge fees south of the border of $9,250 a year for undergraduates. People might argue that students should take on a colossal debt, but this would ultimately weigh on demand in the economy in future years by limiting drastically these individuals' future spending power. More importantly, the prospect of such huge debt will be enough to put many people off a higher education route they might otherwise have pursued, meaning their potential is not realised. Harnessing such potential is crucial to the Scottish economy and to firms in myriad sectors facing a skills and labour shortage crisis that has been exacerbated greatly by Brexit. Scotland faces a major demographic challenge in terms of the trend in its working age population, so it needs all the skilled workers it can get. The UK as a whole also faces such a demographic challenge, although the situation in Scotland is more severe. Given all the griping you hear about Scottish economy, much of it politically motivated, the nation has done rather well, consistently, on the inward investment front in recent years. Highly skilled workforce is a key attraction to overseas companies, so free university tuition will hopefully also help ensure a continuation of Scotland's impressive track record on foreign direct investment. And many of those people in Scotland who benefit from free university tuition and go on to build highly successful careers will stay here and make a very important contribution to the tax base. Not from some kind of graduate tax, that is indeed akin to backdoor tuition fees, but through normal income tax. It's high time people started looking beyond the political soundbites at the reality of the situation. Clearly, it would be a good thing if there were some levelling up by a future UK government to give people in England access to free university tuition. Sadly, that now seems unlikely. However, levelling down is no kind of answer for Scotland when it comes to university tuition. And that was by Ian McConnell. Herald on the 1st of March and the Voices section. What is Scotland's relationship with alcohol in 2024? By Catherine Salmond. As a nation, we have a complex relationship with alcohol. On the one hand, it's a great source of pride. Our world famous brands, for example. Its links to our heritage, employment opportunities, tourism draws, hospitality, inspiring entrepreneurialism. Quite simply, from an economic viewpoint, we need to value and encourage alcohol sales, promotion and consumption. On the other hand, when abused, alcohol is at the root of so many of Scotland's troubles. Addiction, ill health, premature deaths, strains on the NHS, crime, violence. It kills and destroys lives, relationships and communities. We both love and loathe alcohol. But where is this complex relationship at in 2024? My team has been working hard on exploring the question, alive to the many different layers at play. On Monday, we launch a five-day series, Scotland and Alcohol, in response. It's a comprehensive body of work which I'm incredibly proud of my team for. As always, they have worked hard to produce impactful, wide-ranging content, including the business and economic aspects of alcohol, the social, the health, and how it impacts our sporting world. You've spoken with many people, heard their stories, their hopes and concerns, and we are keen to share those with you, our readers. Some of our content is inspiring, some is harrowing, but it tells the full story of Scotland's relationship with drink. We believe it needs to be shared, understood, discussed, and in many areas used to have conversations and apply pressure in areas where solutions are needed. Our series includes full analysis of data from a health perspective, looks at the explosion of small brewers, explores minimum unit pricing, the social role for traditional pubs, the impact of alcohol on children, generational approaches to drinking, and where politics has impacted the industry and drinking culture. It is full, detailed, and thought-provoking. We are keen to hear from you as this important topic is tackled next week. Please share your thoughts. Give us your feedback. The series lasts 5 days, but the much-needed conversations around Scotland and alcohol will last much longer. Many thanks. And that was by Catherine Salmond.
From the Herald Scotland, Sunday the 3rd of March, from the news section, Edinburgh boy's family heartbroken over crash death, by Ginny Sanderson. A heartbroken family has paid tribute to an 11-year-old boy who died after being hit by a bin lorry in Edinburgh. Thomas Wong was riding his bicycle when the crash happened on White House Road, near its junction with Brayhead Road, on Friday, March the 1st. In a statement released through police, his family said, "We are utterly heartbroken. Thomas was the perfect son. He was the best little brother to his older sister and was adored by all his family. Thomas went to Creamon Primary School, which he loved. He made good friends there. We will all miss him terribly. We are very grateful for all the sympathy and heartfelt messages we have received from people. Thank you." Thomas was described by his school community as a kind and friendly boy who was always smiling. Creamon Primary head teacher Helen Donaldson said, "We are utterly devastated by the tragic news of the sudden death of one of our pupils. Our thoughts are with his family and friends during this incredibly difficult time. He was always smiling. He was a positive, friendly and curious member of our school community. He was kind and always eager to support others and will be greatly missed by all of us." Thomas died at the scene of the collision, which happened at about 8:20 a.m, police said. A report will be submitted to the Procurator Fiscal. Inspector Andrew Thompson of Police Scotland's Road Policing Unit said, "Our thoughts are very much with Thomas's family and friends. Specially trained officers are supporting the family at this time. We are continuing with our inquiries to establish the full circumstances of the incident and would appeal to anyone who may have information and has not yet contacted police to get in touch with officers. I would also be keen to speak to anyone who may have dashcam or private CCTV footage from the area. Anyone who can help is asked to call Police Scotland on 101, quoting incident number 0578 of Friday, March the 1st, 2024. And that report was by Ginny Sanderson. From the Herald Scotland, Monday the 4th of March, from the news section, Glasgow East Women's Aid closes permanently following strike. Report by Katrina Stewart. A domestic abuse charity has said it is deeply saddened to announce it is closing following troubled recent months that saw staff walk out over bullying claims. Glasgow East Women's Aid announced on its website that it is to close permanently and will be working with outside organisations as it winds down. Based in the Easterhouse area of the city, the charity has run long-established services for women and children fleeing domestic abuse, but last year, its main office closed for more than 6 weeks following the mass suspension of staff. When 5 staff were then dismissed during a ballot period for strike action, Unite the Union launched legal action against the charity. In a statement, Glasgow East Women's Aid said, "We are deeply saddened by the closure of the organisation. Our priority at this difficult time is to ensure that women and children currently supported by Glasgow East Women's Aid continue to receive the help and support they need, and those who may need support in the future know where to turn. We will continue to liaise with partners, including the regulator, Care Inspectorate, funders, and the council throughout this difficult time. In October last year, more than a dozen whistleblowers at the Women's Aid charity were suspended after making claims of bullying in the workplace. Members of Unite lodged a motion of no confidence in the board and management, and there was a mass suspension of staff. A spokesperson from the GAWA board said, however, that all service users were still being supported and services, rather than staff, had been suspended and were on full pay. This led to a ballot of industrial action, and Unite General Secretary Sharon Graham said at the time whistleblowing staff had been victimised. The 13 Unite members who were suspended were women and children support workers, who provide services for women and children fleeing and experiencing domestic abuse in Greater Easterhouse, one of Scotland's most economically deprived communities. And that report was by Katrina Stewart. From the Herald Scotland, Monday the 4th of March, from a news section, SNP insist ousting Trident not an obstacle to ending Scotland in NATO. Report by Tom Gordon. An independent Scotland could kick out the UK's nuclear weapons while also joining the NATO nuclear alliance, the Scottish Government has insisted. Minister said they would remove the missiles in the safest and most expeditious manner possible following independence. The Scotland and Union group accused the SNP of peddling contradictions and nonsense. In a new paper on ending the Union, SNP minister said removing the Trident deterrent from Faslane Naval Base on the Clyde would not prevent Scotland joining NATO. It said only a minority of NATO's 31 member countries, the USA, France and the UK, had nuclear weapons, and so an independent Scotland would be similar to most of the rest. But there is no alternative berth for the submarines based at Faslane, with an equivalent of the nearby Coalport weapons store, a feature which makes the location unique in the UK. The SNP's critics say it's far-fetched to think that NATO would welcome a new member proposing to undermine the nuclear capability of one of its linchpin founders. The 11th in the Building a New Scotland series, the paper states, this Scottish Government would make it a cornerstone of defence policy that an independent Scotland would only participate in overseas military operations that are lawful, approved by Scottish ministers, and authorised by the Scottish Parliament. Furthermore, nuclear weapons should be removed from Scotland in the safest and most expeditious manner possible following independence. Neither of these proposals would prevent Scotland's ability to act in self-defence or join NATO. This Scottish Government does not regard the removal of nuclear weapons from Scottish soil as an obstacle to independent Scotland's aims of gaining membership of NATO. Only a minority of NATO members host nuclear weapons. An independent Scotland's position would therefore be similar to the approach of most NATO member countries, which neither possess nor host nuclear weapons. Finland's accession to NATO in April 2023 highlighted that hosting nuclear weapons is not a precondition for membership. The paper, An Independent Scotland's Place in the World, also looked at how Scotland could join the United Nations and European Union after a vote for independence. Other areas covered include establishing a dedicated diplomatic network to promote and protect Scottish interests, provide consular support for Scottish citizens, and promote the country as a hub for innovation, trade and investment. The paper also signals a commitment to meet the UN's target of 0.7% of gross national income, GNI, on overseas development aid to help the world's poorest countries, as well as the establishment of new armed forces, informed by an expert-led defence and security review, with a modern contract for personnel and strong support for veterans. Constitution Secretary Angus Robertson said, Scotland is already making a contribution on the world stage where we can to address global poverty, the climate and biodiversity crises, and threats to human rights. But, because we are not independent, Scotland has been forced into Brexit and contributing towards billions of pounds being spent on nuclear weapons. If Scotland had full participation in multilateral bodies, such as the UN, we could ensure our voices heard on critical global issues, such as on the Israel-Gaza conflict. Full representation within associations like the UN and EU would also enable us to negotiate directly, to become party to international treaties, conventions and agreements that reflect Scotland's values and ambitions as a good global citizen. These associations and the benefits they would bring, such as regained access to the world's largest single market and freedom of movement within the EU, would also bring opportunities overseas and at home, helping to develop a competitive economy and support education, skills and jobs, with our strengths in our culture and innovation industries, as well as renewable energy. He went on, "Our proposals also make clear that the armed forces of an independent Scotland, supported by a modern contract for personnel and strong support for veterans, would play their part to defend our national interests and contribute to global peace and security, given our strategic position in the North Atlantic. Ultimately, independence would enable Scotland to determine the kind of state it wants to be on the world stage. We firmly believe that the challenges of the 21st century are best faced through more, not less, cooperation, and I look forward to engaging with as many people as possible on the opportunities highlighted in this paper as we look to Scotland's future." And that report was by political editor Tom Gordon.
This is from the Herald Scotland, on Monday the 4th of March 2024, from Voices section. George Galloway, "Common Stage Set for Maverick MP's Return." Article by Alison Rowett, senior politics and features writer. I wonder if George Galloway will remember to pack his P45 and passport. Having been elected to Parliament 7 times now, the new MP for Rochdale probably knows the drill for entering the House of Commons better than some of the officials who run the place. Still, he has been away from the old Palace of Varieties for 9 years, so perhaps it is worth reacquainting himself with the procedure, as set out in the official new members guide. Congratulations on your election as a Member of Parliament, and welcome to the House of Commons, it begins. Which is certainly a warmer greeting than the one Rishi Sunak delivered on Friday night from his lectern in Downing Street. The guide contains mostly housekeeping stuff, the kind of thing any new start needs to know, where to pick up your security pass, how to get wages and expenses, collecting your tablet and laptop, finding a locker, all that HR jazz. Being a party of one, the Workers' Party of Britain, Mr. Galloway will not have a friendly whip to assign him an office. He may have to flit around for a while, which should be no bother for a man with his experience of travelling for work. He can rest assured, though, that the Rolls-Royce operation that is the House of Commons already has him on the system. The Parliament website has been updated to provide a full rundown of his parliamentary career to date. It's all there for any of his constituents to see. Rochdale, Bradford West, Bethnal Green and Bow, Glasgow Kelvin, elected 2 times, Glasgow Hillhead, elected 2 times, for the Workers' Party of Britain, Respect Party, Independent Labour, and Labour respectively. What do we reckon? Think he'll slip into the Commons quietly, keeping a low profile for a while, stay off the radar while he susses out the lie of the land? Probably not. He has already promised to enter the chamber of the House of Commons like a tornado and shake the walls for Gaza. All sorts of intriguing details remain to be sorted out, including who he will ask to introduce him in the chamber and where he will sit. I can't see Lib Dem or SNP MPs willingly budging along to accommodate him. How soon will he pop up at Prime Minister's Questions? What will the younger MPs make of the 69-year-old new kid on the block? However Galloway plays it, his arrival will be an event, which is just as well, since what was supposed to be the week's other Dear Diary moment, the budget on Wednesday, was yesterday shaping up to be a damp squib. The final budget in what is widely expected to be an election year was not supposed to be like this. When the Prime Minister and his Chancellor replaced the disastrous Truss-Quertang combo last October, the two men made a virtue of how boring politics was going to be from now on. But come the new year, Jeremy Hunt began presenting himself as a chancellor from the same mould as the tax-slashing Nigel Lawson. Hunt's stock with the Tory right increased, as did expectations of a pre-election giveaway. Adding to Tory MPs' excitement was a forecast from the Independent Office for Budget Responsibility in November, telling the Chancellor he would have £30 billion to spend. It was no longer a question of whether income tax and national insurance would be cut, but how far would the Chancellor and Prime Minister, another Lawsonite, dare to go? Talk about tempting fate. Hunt learned from the OBR on Friday night that the forecast had been revised and his room for manoeuvre was more like £12.5 billion. That would explain the downbeat coverage of the spring budget in yesterday's papers and the Chancellor's demeanour as he toured the Sunday politics programmes. Gone was the talk of a tax-cutting budget to be replaced by a prudent and responsible budget for long-term growth. Either Mr. Hunt should be in the running for a Best Actor Oscar, or he is talking down expectations of his budget. But is he doing so because he has nothing to pull out of his hat? Or is he planning a surprise raid on one of the few revenue-raising measures Labour has left, abolishing the non-dom tax status? Mr. Hunt has not been in favour of this in the past, arguing that it will encourage the rich to relocate and pay their taxes elsewhere. But he would not be the first Chancellor to change his mind and cite changing circumstances in his defence. Then again, he told BBC One Sunday with Laura Kunzberg that the public sees through gimmicks and there would be none in his budget. Labour could initially crow about the theft of its non-dom policy, but it would leave an incoming Starmer government with a huge black hole in its finances. Labour has been counting on the measure to raise in the region of £2 billion. Rachel Reeves, the Shadow Chancellor, said the party would revisit our plans if the Tories pinched the policy. But it is hard to see where else the money could come from. So determined have Starmer and Reeves been to cut spending commitments to the bone. Anyway the Chancellor slices and dices it on Wednesday, his budget will leave Labour with a problem. There are no pots of gold left. Remember that infamous jokey note a Labour minister left for his Tory successor? Dear Chief Secretary, I'm afraid there is no money. Hunt might want to start working on a variation of that. Hunt left himself wriggle room yesterday in saying that whatever else the budget did, it would show a path towards a lower tax economy. Hardly the most inspiring promise ever set before voters, but at least it hints at a country that is moving forward. Labour, in contrast, is giving the impression that the best it can do in what will be a tough few years ahead is just hold the line. That in turn will have an impact on Scottish Labour's showing at the next Scottish Parliament elections. The first years of a Starmer government were meant to be a showcase for Scottish voters, a chance to see what they too could have if they upended the status quo. Promising more of the same, or worse, is not going to inspire anyone, voter or MSP. The Chancellor's downplaying of expectations, should that turn out to be the case, fits with the times. Suddenly, the long slog to the election seems even longer. That article was by Alison Rowett.
The Herald on the 5th of March and the news section. Scotland in a grip of housing emergency, industry experts warn, by Jodie Harrison. Scotland's housing professionals have declared the country is in the grip of a housing emergency ahead of delegates coming together for a two-day conference in Glasgow this week. The Chartered Institute of Housing, CIH Scotland, will set out its thinking during this year's Scotland Housing Festival, which starts at the SEC Glasgow on Tuesday. The organisation will discuss housing shortages during the assembly and call for actions from both the UK and Scottish governments to address what it sees as a worsening situation across the country. It comes after three local authorities, Argyll and Bute, Edinburgh and Glasgow, declared housing emergencies in their respective areas last year, with more councils expected to follow shortly. Last week, it was reported that the Scottish Government had reduced the affordable housing supply budget by £196 million, with new homeless figures suggesting more than 30,000 people currently have nowhere permanent to live. CIH Scotland's declaration of a housing emergency is expected to be discussed during the opening session of the two-day festival, which will bring together hundreds of housing professionals, speakers and exhibitors to talk about the latest issues and challenges facing the sector. The second day of the conference will start with a breakfast general election hustings session, giving delegates the chance to hear the priorities of each of the five main political parties and ask questions, followed by a discussion around housing legislation and another question and answer session. CIH Scotland National Director Callum Chomsuk said ahead of the conference, "Scotland is in the midst of a housing emergency and we need a political response. We want to see the UK budget on Thursday provide increased spending, increased capital spending and clarity over future financial transaction allocations, which would mean more funding could be provided for affordable housing in the coming year. However, we also want to see the Scottish Government prioritise delivery and building of affordable housing. We want to see the affordable housing budget front loaded so social landlords can keep building, as it is always going to be cheaper to build today than it is tomorrow. The Scottish budget last week fell far short of what the sector has been asking for, but it is never too late to invest in people, invest in communities and invest in social housing. We need an emergency plan and funding for delivering the social homes in Scotland needs." The Scottish Government spokesperson said the survey of a small number of landlords is at odds with what the latest Scottish Landlord Register data show, where the number of registered properties for rent in Scotland between August 2022, 339,632, and January 2024, 345,374, has increased by 1.7%. Private renting is also a very dynamic sector and has always been characterised by some landlords leaving and others entering. Our emergency legislation has protected tenants at a time when private rents have been rising steeply across the UK. Since April 1, 2023, private landlords have been able to increase a tenant's rent in tenancy by up to 3%, or can apply to Rent Service Scotland for approval of an increase of up to 6% in specific circumstances. The emergency measures also included safeguards for those landlords who may be impacted by the cost of living crisis. The UK government has been contacted for comment. And that was by Jodie Harrison. The Herald on the 5th of March and the news section. Stonehaven Orange Walk opposed by 10,000 strong petition by Jodie Harrison. Almost 10,000 people have signed a petition against a march that is set to mark the opening of a new Orange Lodge in a Scottish town. Hundreds of marchers are expected to participate in the Orange Walk in Aberdeenshire for the new lodge opening in Stonehaven. The Grand Orange Lodge of Scotland has applied to use the town hall as a gathering point, with 200 people expected to take part. However, the petition describes the march as deeply rooted in sectarianism and adds not only would this event, with 200 marchers bust in, severely disrupt daily activities and cause significant traffic congestion, but it also risks poisoning our peaceful environment. We've seen too often elsewhere how Orange Order parades foment a threatening atmosphere and can spill over into violence and abuse. This intimidatory practice cannot be justified on the grounds of freedom and of expression. The petition further urges local councillors to use their power and influence to prevent this event. The planned state marches will then go from Stonehaven's town hall in Allardyce Street to the cemetery at Dunottar Church on March 16 at 2 p.m. It's also expected to go through Bridgefield, Donatory Avenue and Lowood Road. Around 9,500 locals have signed a petition in a bid to try and block the event. Stonehaven's Community Council have said that we've put up a vigorous fight on their behalf to stop it from going ahead. The decision on whether or not the march should go ahead is set to be made today at Aberdeenshire Council's latest Kincardine and Mearns area committee. Councillors will discuss if it will go ahead or not, and if it does, then if it should proceed with any conditions or restrictions or not. And according to the Press and Journal, Stonehaven District and Community Council has held emergency talks over the march proposals. Community Council spokesperson said the Press and Journal, Stonehaven and District Community Council congratulates the community on its response to the proposed Orange Walk in Stonehaven. The Community Council will put up a vigorous fight against this proposed Orange Walk on behalf of the community. A spokesperson for the Grand Orange Lodge of Scotland previously told the Scottish Sun, the Grand Orange Lodge of Scotland are delighted that a new lodge will be opening in Stonehaven. Residents in Stonehaven and surrounding areas applied to open the new lodge last year, to which the Grand Lodge of Scotland in session approved. Many of the brethren who will be in this new lodge are current members and had been travelling from Stonehaven to other lodges in surrounding towns like Aberdeen, Forfar, Peterhead and Perth, and with significant interest from local people in Stonehaven, it was agreed that these numbers warranted a new lodge opening in Stonehaven. Should the committee decide enough information about the procession has been provided, members will be asked to determine whether to impose conditions, whether to prohibit the procession, or whether to take no action at all, a spokesperson for the council said. And that was by Jody Harrison.
That concludes this week's edition of the Herald Scotland podcast. Please remember to subscribe to our channels at Hear and Review and tell your friends about our service.